Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, you're putting the sick man on line mark, which meets every Sunday night, 8 o'clock, for 4 hours, 8 o'clock until midnight, for those who can stay up that late. And even if you can't stay up that late, there's a way where you can find a recording of the last 10 years worth of TechNets that are at, why can't I think of the name of it? I get the call letters all of a sudden. Mike, KC2NJI, runs this website called amateurradio.tv. You go to amateurradio.tanglevictor, and the last 10 years worth of TechNets are all recorded. So there are people who can't stay up that late, and they go to that website a few days after the net, download it to into their recording device, and that gives them the ability to listen to the rest of the TechNet as they're driving to work, as they're on the train, on their lunch hour, and so on. Can we drop? The TechNet is a gathering of curious people who want to know more about radio and how it works and how to make it work better. And they help each other. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City, tri-state area of New Jersey, lower New York State, western Connecticut, Long Island. That's where this group is primarily stationed. That's the mass center of this group. However, by way of Echolink and IRLP, people from much greater distances are occasionally signing in. And from people from much greater distances, we now know are listening in. John, KC2WGB, monitors the Echolink and the chat room. And so if we're too quick on the mic and don't wait for all four beeps, you get locked out, so to speak. John will know about it and brings it to our attention. The TechNet has got an extremely loose schedule that we follow. For the first hour, we take check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 33 years, and this is TechNet number 1599 that you're about to listen to, by now we believe somebody's listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So for the first hour, we take those questions, try to give answers. No guarantee that all the answers are 100% accurate, but it does go through a kind of a peer review by way of the amateurradio.tv website. Lots of people listen to those recordings, and when we make an error, somebody brings it to our attention, and we correct that. One of the things, let me drop. I was an electronic engineer for 40 years, a good deal of it, 35 years of it, was at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And one of the things that a realistic engineer has to admit to himself, and not many of them can do that, is that nobody bats a thousand. No matter how hard you try, a certain number of your engineering pronouncements, your electrical technology pronouncements, a certain percentage of them are going to be an error. And a smart person realizes he's given it a sincere effort, and he'll laugh at himself and go on from that error and profit from the error itself. So occasionally error occurs. The second thing that happens on the TechNet is that at approximately 9 o'clock, if we're really enthusiastic, sometimes it gets pushed off till 9:30, 9:45, John, KC2WGB, presents his mailbag information. In other words, people who don't yet have the right ham license or the right equipment to talk to us directly, they send a message to John, and he takes one, two, three, or four of those that have general interest, and we discuss them. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, will tell us the latest in what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the European Space Agency and so on, what they've been doing. And I frequently ask him, how is Voyager doing? That's the most far-reaching piece of electronics that mankind has ever issued. Something like 12 billion miles away is Voyager, three times the distance to Pluto. And it continues to talk to us. What a piece of hardware. Let me drop. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins with people who do have a question or a comment for the net. So please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your call letters and name right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
November 2, Echo, stick with a comment, and so we go.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
VBN, question.
Okay, VBN. I should know you, and I should know your prefix. Squeeze the mic, wait a second or two, Tell us your full call letters and your name, sir. Mr. VBN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
62, Kilo Bravo, Victor Bravo, November, ready, in Rockaway. Just want to know about the jammer. They said the jammer got caught. He was in court the other day. He got shot with 7 sub. That's all I want to know.
Okay, we got the full call letters of Freddy. Let's see. So far we got Rich, Freddy. Anyone else to check in, because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes right now.
W2SAW, Bill, yes.
I think that's Whiskey 2, Sierra Alpha Whiskey. We got you, Bill. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now. K2RIW listening.
Kilo Delta 2, Canada Golf Lima, Robert, yes.
Okay, Mr. Canada Golf Lima, Kilo Delta 2, we got you, Robert. All right, I think we got more than enough to get started. Rich said he had a comment. N2, Echo Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Jake, I hope you can copy me. Hopefully I'm in a sweet spot. Just wanted to say hello to everybody, all my friends and friends-to-be, and I should be out of here very shortly and back home. And to we up.
Yes, Rich, you did find a sweeter spot than last week when we were having trouble copying. A little bit noisy, but we heard all of your words. And Rich is in a rehabilitation center, and sounds like he's going to be leaving there pretty soon and coming back home to Massapequa Park. Okay, the next person who signed in was Freddie. And Freddie, I know you're asking about the jammer situation. And I think that might not be appropriate for the TechNet. I know that lots of progress is being made. I know that LIMOC members get written notices. They get specific written information by way of the monthly journal, the LIMOC log. And so for the people who are club members, by way of those communication techniques, they find out what is the current status. I'm not sure it's appropriate to announce over the air what is being done, what progress is being made. So I don't think we can just...
You're absolutely right, Dick. It's not appropriate.
Okay, I thought so, John. So Freddie, I'm... Okay, you too, Jack. Okay, here's one of the board members, so go right ahead, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
No, I'm not a board member, but on the Monday Night InfoNet, it has been announced that one of our problem people, whose name is Danny, was arrested, and the whole story was given out on Monday night. So, if you're interested, it's printed in the ARRL letter. It's also been published in a couple other places, but. The one guy in Australia that's been a pain has been caught and is in the process of being hung by his thumb. So, there you go.
Okay, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW in the group, I thank you for that information, Eric. If Freddie wants further information, is there a particular website you know of that he could go to where he could read more? I presume it's part of the... some of these social networks, I can't even think of the names of them right now, but where would a person go who wants to read further information? Over to you, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW.
I believe I am correct in saying that to go to hudson.arrl.org or, nli.arrl.org, there's a write-up about it in there.
Very fine, Eric. Good information. And while I've got you on the line right now, I did send you a very late email with some information where, if you had the time later on, we could have a further discussion on what you and I started last week. I've got a number of communications where people were very excited by that interchange that you and I had, and they'd like to hear more of it. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and see if you might be available for that later, Eric. Go ahead.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, I got your letter. I didn't really have time to go over it, but I will in a while. Although I did take a quick look at the patent, and, you know, couldn't spend the amount of time that I wanted to because I was a bit busy, but in about a half hour, I'm going to go over it again, and we can pick it up later.
Okay. Based on the assumption that Eric might have the time to review the material, Eric and I began a discussion last week as to computer modeling of antennas in particular. And computer modeling has come a long way. It has a lot to be, a lot of benefit comes from that method of approach of antenna design for a certain class of antennas, maybe even the majority of the antennas. But there's a certain kind of subclass of antennas that I've worked on where the computer modeling, in my opinion, presently does not give valid or useful information. That's my opinion, and everyone's going to agree with that. And the computer modeling is going to continuously improve, and that's probably going to change. But there's a whole class of antennas that I've worked on where computer modeling appears not to work. Eric was present at New York Institute of Technology 25 or so years ago, in which a lot of computer modeling, computer-generated graphics was essentially being created, invented, and whatever. And those professors at that time gave Eric the impression that there's a very rosy future for computer modeling and computer-generated graphics. Is that approximately what was taking place about 20, 25 years ago at New York Institute of Technology, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW. Fill us in if you would like. It's your choice.
Oh, gives a minute. The guy, he's got a good memory. Actually, a lot of the stuff that you see that's photoshopped and After Effects and all these programs are actually developed by different groups of people in the Office Institute of Technology and the Computer Graphics Lab, with one of them MIT, Francis, Missouri, at University of Ohio, Evans and Sutherland in California, in Sunnyvale. And actually, a lot of these folks went on to go work for George Lucas, and that became Pixar eventually.
So if I understand correctly, Eric, you were there at Ground Zero when that technology was being developed at New York Institute of Technology, and apparently they were one of the main centers that were the birthplace of that kind of computer-generated graphics, computer modeling, computer designing, and so on. So at that time, I get the impression that one of the major mass centers in the United States where that kind of research was taking place was at NYIT. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, actually, if you're interested in the story of how that started, it's actually quite interesting. It was one of the places. Don't forget that in those days, he came up with a good algorithm. He published it in the SIGGRAPH Journal, and everybody and his brother knew what it was. So it's a different world today, but in the beginning, it was really quite interesting. And how the graphics lab got started is even a more interesting story, and if you're interested in it, I'll tell you later.
Very fine, Eric. Okay, we're looking forward to that later on. Next person on the list was Bill, Whiskey 2, Sierra Alpha Whiskey. What would you like to talk about, Bill? What would you like to ask about? We'll discuss anything except antennas, and that's a joke, of course. You've got it, Bill. W2S, AW, K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. My question is about scalability of antennas, and are they perfectly scalable across the band? If so, why do people build large anechoic chambers instead of model things at about 900 megs? And the second part of my question is, what would be the practicality of scaling up one of your RFID Yagis to the 2 meter range? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a darn good question, Bill. One of the universal laws of electronics and antennas in particular is that they were 99.99% scalable. That is to say, if you change every single dimension of an antenna, diameters of the radiators, length of the radiators, chamfering at the end, length of the boom, diameter of the boom, size of the shoulder bushings, if that's the way you're mounting the antenna elements to the boom, and so on. If you scale every single element of both the conductors and the non-conductors, then they are, all the past experience says that they are 100% scalable as a function of wavelength. You go to a higher frequency, let's say you double the frequency for whatever reason, which really means you've got half the size of the wavelength, and if you have all of the dimensions and rebuild that antenna and test it, you should get the exact same performance of gain, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, side lobe levels, notch levels, all of that should be the same, polarization characteristics, and so on. Let me drop. Therefore, to really test an antenna, you've got, at an HF frequency, you've got two choices. You either use what's called the reflective ground plane antenna range characteristic, reflective ground plane antenna range philosophy or technique. An awful lot of that was put forward by Dr. Dick Turin at Bell Laboratories, W2IMU, Whiskey 2, India, Mike, Uniform. You Google his call letters in the ARRL archives of past articles, or if you look him up in the, I think it's the VHF handbook, the third edition of the VHF handbook. There's an article by Dick Turin telling you how to set up an antenna range. So under normal circumstances, the ground reflection when you're testing an HF antenna gives you a fair amount of grief. But there's ways of bypassing the grief of the ground plane with the so-called reflective ground plane antenna range technique. A little bit elaborate. Lots of guys have used it. That's one approach. Let me drop. Another approach is the one that you're advocating right now, Bill, and that is if you know you want an antenna at 14 megacycles and you build a 1400 megacycle equivalent, you scale everything down by the 100 to 1 because you're 100 times higher in frequency, and you scale all the dimensions 100 times smaller. To build an anechoic chamber at 915 megacycles is doable. To build a good anechoic chamber at 9 gigahertz, now that's 1,000 times higher in frequency, a hell of a lot easier. So you go high enough in frequency, the anechoic chambers you can probably build with your hands, with not too expensive equipment, by scaling the antenna to a higher frequency, you can now build the higher frequency antenna, tune it, tweak it, and so on, measure its characteristics, and know that when you build the HF equivalent, as long as you scale every one of the dimensions, you will get the same performance. Let me drop. And the third technique for your unusual antenna, which is very hard to test in the real world, is to do computer modeling. But you got to be careful with the computer modeling. How much fidelity is there in your computer model? Is it really
Let it drop, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric. What did you say?
I'm trying to figure out why 375 doesn't keep coming back. You waited for the last season and didn't come back, so I'm just asking you to let it drop for a second.
Okay, I'm hearing 375 on the air right now, and my audio is a lot louder on 375 than it is on 85. So it looks like it has come back. I better keep checking it periodically, is what I think you're suggesting. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, where I am, I'm trying to get internet, and I'm going to dig into why it's not coming back all the time. So carry on, but keep an ear open for it. You'll see it drops out once in a while.
And we've also got to make sure we listen for all four beeps and maybe another second beyond to make sure everything gets properly reset. So there's kinds of computer modeling which, if you carry it out with enough fidelity, if you put enough of the raw data of your antenna into it, it does a pretty good job. Ordinary Yagis with small diameter elements, like a 432 Yagi with a 316 diameter element, and let's say 1 inch or so diameter boom. Modeling that with EasyNeck and some of those other modeling programs, Yagi, what's it called now? Yagi Fidelity. There's two or three Yagi modeling programs that appear to work very well, and people are happy with them. That's the good news. Okay. when you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, and you can find them on the website of what can I think of his call letters right now? K1MJM, Mike number two. You go to his website, which is LimachTechNet.com. You will find information on K2LIW, Yagi, modeling, and so on. You will find the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Mr. Brown, Mr. Woodward, way back in 1946, I think they were doing this at Bell Labs, made some extremely careful measurements of monopole antennas, quarter wave ground plane monopole antennas on a very large sheet of metal in which, let me drop, in which they tried every reasonable diameter, every reasonable length, and all the reasonable frequencies. In other words, they modeled the way a monopole on a large ground plane really acts. A dipole antenna, which is the most basic antenna we're all using in some form almost all the time. The dipole is the driven element of your Yagi. A half a dipole, a monopole, is the main probe that's inside a waveguide of your waveguide to coax adapter if you're using a horn. So a high percentage of the antennas in the world have a dipole or a half dipole in it. And as I said, a dipole is really a pair of quarter wave ground planes back to back. That's exactly what it is. And as such, when you make the measurement on a quarter wave ground plane, except for the fact that all the impedances are one half of what they would be for a full dipole, you've now got all the real measured data. And any attempt to make a computer modeling program that will give you all those curves of all those diameters and all those lengths at all those frequencies, any attempt to make a computer, to make an equation to fit that, in my opinion, essentially doesn't work. Unless you're extremely close to the resonant frequency. You go a little bit away from the resonant frequency, and all of those equations break down, and so therefore you have to go back to the real data. Let me drop it. So that real data, it's the most, arguably it is the most valuable piece of basic information about antenna design that you can lay your hands on. It is hidden in plain sight in Chapter 4. Of every single issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And you'd be amazed how many skilled antenna engineers with 20 years of experience don't even know it's there. The particular professor they had in school led them to believe that computer modeling is the be-all, end-all, and they didn't think they have to do anything else. For the majority of the antennas that are being used and designed these days, that's essentially true. But now you take the class of antennas like the 900 megacycle, 915 megacycle, three-element, sheet metal Yagi that is now being used on thousands of RFID interrogators. And I gave you guys the patent number of that antenna last week, and I can do that again later on. You look at the shape of that thing. Each of the elements are approximately a 10 to 1 ratio between diameter and length. Let me drop. At first, a 10 to 1 ratio doesn't sound significant. But if you use a basic piece of information, we all have done. A high percentage of the people in the sound of my voice have built a dipole on 80 meters. And we probably did it with 14-gauge wire. 14-gauge wire, 16th of an inch diameter, and the half-wave dipole is roughly 132 feet long. That diameter to length ratio is 25,000 to 1. The curves of Brown and Woodward go from roughly 4 to 1 all the way up to 1,000 to 1. They don't go anywhere near as high as 25,000 to 1. But you can see the trend. As the length to diameter ratio becomes a bigger and bigger number, the curves become more and more steep. The Q of the antenna gets higher and higher. The antenna becomes more and more narrowband. You can see that by looking at those curves, particularly the reactance curve. Let me drop. See, you can just imagine what happens at a 25,000 to 1 ratio. That's the reason why your 80 meter dipole starts rising in standing wave ratio pretty fast. At the ends of the band, if you tuned it for the center of the 80 meter band, 3750 kilohertz, and you go down to 3500 and up to 4000, boy, the Biswa stands starts rising real fast. I think you can easily hit a 6 to 1 Biswa on each of the bend, each of the ends of that band. So without an antenna tuner, going there is not easy, if you know what I mean. So, an ordinary 80 meter dipole is a rather high Q structure. If you could make the ratio not 25,000 to 1 diameter to length ratio, but if you could make it 10 to 1, like I did on that three-element sheet metal Yagi at 915 megacycles, you would get that great performance. By that I mean, let me drop. Over that 3% bandwidth, that Yagi gives you something like a 1.05 standing wave ratio, maximum, across the whole 28 megacycles, from 902 to 928, that's what, 26 megacycles, across the whole 26 megacycles, 3% bandwidth, it gives you something like a 1.02 or 1.05 standing wave ratio, unheard of, whereas your 3% or so bandwidth you're going to get across 80 meters is going to give you a 6 to 1 standing wave ratio, where the reflection coefficient is 3 dB down instead of 25 dB down. Huge difference. Primarily because of diameter of elements combined with some exotic tuning. When you look at that Yagi, you realize it's got a very funny shape to it. It's got bulbous things on the end of each of the elements. It's got funny curves to the elements. The elements are very wide, flat, with holes in them in order to allow the bonding of the injection molded rubber that goes around the antenna. Let me drop it. It also has a sheet metal equivalent of a gamma match to the driven element, but there's no capacitor there, if you know what I mean. An ordinary gamma match has got a length of conductor going off to one side on the driven element in order to feed it. And it's usually a series capacitor. This thing doesn't have one of those. So it's unusual in a number of ways. That's why a separate patent was issued for that Yagi antenna, even though the basic Yagi was invented way back in 1928 by Mr. Yagi. This is Hindusugu Yagi, I think it's pronounced. And Mr. Uda was his student that helped him and did most of the work. So therefore, some people will call it a Yagi-Uda antenna or Uda-Yagi antenna. So, to some degree, I was involved in reinventing the Yagi antenna way back in 2004, I think is when we filed that one. And it took about 5 years for that patent to be granted. They at first didn't believe in all that we were claiming as to what it was doing and what the difference was. Let me drop. So if you built a three-element Yagi on, let's say, 10 meters, where the length would be 16 feet long for a half-wave dipole, and you had a 10-to-1 ratio between diameter and length, so you'd have 1.6 feet in diameter for the driven element and the director and the reflector. Duplicated the physics of that, the physical dimensions of that Yagi, yes, you would get that performance. Is it worth it? Now, bear in mind that that antenna is maximized in gain, but primarily maximized in standing wave ratio, because a RFID reader, RFID interrogator, is a kind of a CW radar. It is transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency simultaneously. Let me drop. As such, any reflected signal from your own antenna when you're transmitting, which really is the reflected standing wave ratio, any reflected signal comes back and jams your own receiver as receiving on the exact same frequency at the exact same time. So if you can make the reflection coefficient due to the standing wave ratio of your antenna, if you can make that reflection coefficient minus 25 or minus 30 dB, that's where you get the pay dirt. That's where your RFID reader starts developing good sensitivity and great range. But you go to any antenna manufacturer on planet Earth, and you tell him, since the normal antennas are manufactured to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio maximum, which, by the way, is approximately a 10 dB reflection coefficient, and if you are willing to pay the extra premium dollars, they will give you a 1.5-to-1. Standing wave ratio antenna, which is something like a 15 dB reflection coefficient. And you tell him, I want to buy an antenna from you at 1.05 Biswa, minus 25 or minus 30 dB of reflection coefficient. Every one of those antenna manufacturers will say, no way, no bid, go away, you're crazy, I'll get no yield if I try to build that. So they think it's impossible. Well, we found a company in Taiwan, Taipei, Taiwan, that's doing it for us, once we give them the design and ask them to duplicate it with a reasonably high accuracy. So it's being done, and they're being shipped, and they're being used. So So the impossible has become possible, if you know what I mean. But there's a huge philosophical difference of opinion as to, let me drop it. Of the tradition of those kind of antennas. Now, the tradition is that 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is typical. If you're willing to pay a premium, 1.5-to-1, you can buy. But you start asking for 1.05-to-1, and they'll say, go away. Nobody will do it. Well, we did find a company that will do it if we give them the design and tell them what dimensions and so on, this crazy shape. So you could build that at 10 meters. It'd be a little bit difficult, but what would you get in return? You'd get a reasonable amount of gain for a three-element Yagi. That's the good news. You'd get extremely high performance in standing wave ratio. But because you're not using it as an RFID reader, that huge performance in standing wave ratio, you don't need it. Your typical 80 through 10 meter transceiver will not appreciate the fact that the standing wave ratio is 1.05-to-1 because you're capable of doing that at each individual frequency by using your antenna tuner. Let me drop. You could say the problem with a handheld RFID tag reader is that it doesn't have a built-in antenna tuner of the kind that you put on your rig. The room for it is not there, and the speed of operation is not there. I'm speaking now in general. There happens to be a couple of companies working on building exotic integrated circuits that can do this. But because of the way the license-free band operates between 902 and 928, every fraction of a second you must be hopping to another frequency, 50 separate frequencies between 902 and 928, in order to not dwell on any one frequency so that you're not jamming somebody's a cordless telephone. You've got to continuously be hopping. Therefore, your antenna tuner would have to continuously be hopping in its tuning. I didn't say it's undoable. It's very difficult and costly. So, to build an antenna that's got the built-in bandwidth, standing wave ratio-wise, you get this advantage, but I don't think you need that advantage, Bill. It's nice to know it's there, and you can be bragging about the fact that you've got the performance when you're on, let's say, the 10-meter band, if you did build that antenna. And you could build it with sheet metal, by the way. But I don't think you need it. But then again, for all I know, Bill, you're enough of a scientist that you'd like to go there and start doing some further experimenting with exotic antennas. W2SAW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, wow. Thanks, Dick. That was a pretty comprehensive answer. Yeah, I was just wondering when I looked at, I think it was 7205953, just wondering what kind of an antenna you'd have on 2 meters for sideband operations. But, yeah, that's a pretty good answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah, now that I remember, you did ask for 2 meters. I gave you an example of 10 meters. 2 meters, where, let's see, a quarter wavelength is 19 inches, 36 inches, 38, a little more than 3 feet, 1/10. You'd have to make a diameter of the elements of approximately 3 feet to make, I said 3 feet, let me think, 3 foot long, 1/10 of that, a third of a foot. Yeah, I may have some of the mathematics wrong here. 10 meters, 16 feet. Okay, 2 meters. 2 meters, it would be 3/10 of a foot in diameter. You could do that. You could do that. If you didn't do it just right with sheet metal, if you did it with round objects, a third of a foot in diameter, by building birdcage elements for your director-driven element reflector, by birdcage, you can keep the weight down, you can keep the wind load fairly low, or you can build it on a wide piece of sheet metal, a third of an inch wide for each of the elements, and lay it flat to the ground. That would lower the wind load. You could do that. That would be kind of fun. You've given me some ideas. Next time I set up my backyard ratiometry antenna range, which, by the way, you can read about that in QST magazine. I think it was the February issue, 1976, I think it was. You go to the ARRL archives and you do a search on K2LIW articles. You'll find this backyard antenna range, which gives you extremely high accuracy. Let me drop. Yeah, I think I heard the 975-375 just coming back on. The next time I set up that antenna range, it would be tempting to build a 2 meter equivalent. It's kind of funny looking, but it'd be a lot of fun to do that. You're giving me some ideas there, Bill. The next person who has a question for the TechNet tonight was Robert. Golf Lima. Go right ahead, Robert. K2RIW in the tech net.
Hello. This is going to be a little bit different. About 20 years ago, I was sitting in the back of a Suffolk County bus, a full in a very stretched out. The driver, somebody cut in front of the driver and he's on the brakes. Next thing you know, I'm sitting on the floor by the driver, perfectly okay. The question is, how fast was I remember anything for the time I was in the front? And how many G's was generated back to that?
There was a huge number of dropouts, 1 second at a time.
The audio.
Okay, you think it was the audio doing it. Okay, so repose your question, but speak a lot softer. According to Eric, your deviation is far enough that you're jumping out of the channel, and therefore the PO demodulator is chopping you out, Robert. So please repeat your question, but you got to speak more softly. KD2, CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I just reduced the mic gain. That might have something to do with it. Yeah, about 20 years ago, I was sitting on the back of a Suffolk County bus, in the middle, in a comfortable position. Somebody cut in front of the driver and he hit the brakes. Next thing you know, I'm sitting on the floor by the driver. How fast was I going? I don't remember anything from the time I was sitting in the back to the time I was sitting in the front. It was instantaneous. How many...
Okay, for the first 90%, you spoke softly, and everything came through good. And then the last 10 seconds, you either spoke louder, got closer to the mic, or whatever, and you started chopping it. But I got the point. You probably know, I don't know if I sent you a copy, I did create a memo in the last week about so-called red light cameras, and in a number of cases, I believe they represent an entrapment device where if you're at a particular distance from the light when it turns yellow, and then you decide to either continue at your speed and hope you get through it before it turns red, or start applying the brakes, and there's a particular distance you could be from that light that just turned yellow where if you apply the brakes, you don't have enough time to brake before hitting the light, or if you continue going forward at your constant speed, you don't have enough time to get through it. In either case, they're going to be sending you a citation. That's if you're using a third of a G of deceleration. And by my standards, a third of a G is a certain amount of braking force, which is right at the threshold of being uncomfortable. The other people in the car, if they're not strapped in with their seatbelts, might start moving forward and their head goes toward the windshield, if you know what I mean, at anything greater than one-third G. Let me drop.
That's the question.
I'm getting there. What I'm getting at is that if the automobile has anti-lock braking, and if you do a real hard panic stop, and if you've got anti-lock braking so that none of the wheels are sliding, and if you're on dry macadam or dry concrete with a good set of tires, many vehicles will approach 1G. In other words, the weight of the vehicle pressing down on the tire will give you a coefficient of friction of approximately unity. In other words, if this particular tire has 1,000 pounds pressing down on it, that tire is passable in a nearly locked wheel condition to give you 1,000 pounds of braking force. That calculates to be 1G. So many a vehicle in a panic stop can get very close to 1G. And maybe that bus did it. If it had the four good sets of brakes and anti-lock braking on all four wheels. And 1G is an amount of braking that if the people are not tied down with a seatbelt, they will be going forward in the vehicle. And if it's in a passenger car, the head will quite frequently be hitting the windshield. On top of that, you use that kind of panic braking, you're just about guaranteed that the person behind you is going to tail end you. You're going to have an accident with the person behind you because no matter what he does, he can't stop fast enough. Let me drop. So my point is, that an extremely well-equipped vehicle in good operating condition on dry road can give you an amount of deceleration approaching 1G. Do not use it. Unless it's a real panic situation and you're about to T-bone a bus, don't do it if you know what I mean. On top of that, you and I can buy vehicles, particularly some of these modern-day electrically powered vehicles, which can go 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds. You do that on a public road, and boy, you're doing something very foolish. So the fact that you can buy a vehicle that can accelerate very fast or decelerate very fast doesn't mean you should do it. And that's sort of the answer you're looking for. You could have been approaching 1G during a portion of that stop. Therefore, that could have caused you to go sliding across that floor. And had you been continuously doing that, in theory, you could have slid across that floor and go smashing into the windshield of that bus. Over to you, Bill. W2. Oh, that's a Robert. KD2, CGL. K2LIW, you got it, Robert.
I'm sitting on the floor. Remember, so I must have been pretty darn quick. What do you think the velocity was? It had to be fast.
Comment.
I heard the word comment. Please hang in there. Robert, 85% of that last transmission didn't come through. You were chopped out. But I can tell you're asking the question, how fast do you think the bus was moving? Whether the bus was moving 10 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour, in either case, with extremely hard braking on a very good braking system, with anti-lock braking, you can approach 1G. The good news about starting that at 10 miles an hour is that the duration of that stopping before you come to a full stop will probably be, 1 second, whereas you do it at 70 miles an hour, 1G is going to take you something like 5 seconds to come to a stop, and there's a way of calculating that. So how fast you are going doesn't change the number of Gs. It changes the duration of the deceleration. Therefore, you could say it changes the amount of slide of your bottom across the floor of that bus, so to speak. The faster he goes, the longer it's going to take for that deceleration. Therefore, you've got a larger amount of time to be sliding and then eventually hitting something. And it's a rather sad state of affairs. Let me drop it.
Don't forget the mass of the bus.
It's a very sad state of affairs that people in a bus and people in a taxi in general do not wear a seatbelt. They think there's something magic about those vehicles that a seatbelt is not required. And one of the key people of 60 Minutes program, 6 months or so ago, was in a New York City taxi cab, not wearing a seatbelt, and because of an accident that occurred on the New York City streets, he ended up leaving the taxi cab and losing his life. Had he been wearing a seatbelt, that most likely would not have happened. And almost nobody climbs into a taxi cab and uses the seatbelt, even though it's there. Now, you just said something, Eric. You have to repeat it. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
I just wanted you to point out the fact that a car may weigh 3,000 to 4,000 pounds. It's massive, but it's a heck of a lot heavier, and it takes a little more to slow that inertia down, so the distance that it will travel will be a little further.
Okay, I think what you're saying, Eric, is that yes, a bus has a lot more mass to it, without a doubt, which also means there's more weight on the wheels, creating the friction of deceleration. Are you implying that the maximum coefficient of friction between a rubber wheel and the road on an automobile, which can approach unity, are you implying that the coefficient of friction of a bus wheel in the road cannot approach unity? If it can approach unity, then that bus can also decelerate at 1G, even though it's a heavier vehicle. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
Well, I am saying that to overcome the forces of inertia is just greater. Okay, I didn't really suggest that you get less or more contact with wheels. the heavier your vehicle when you're traveling. You know, there used to be a rule that if you were traveling at 10 miles an hour, you leave one car length. If you're traveling 20 miles an hour, you leave two car lengths. So that way you can stop. Now, with the red light camera, you see the yellow light, you're going to slam on the brakes. You've got that much more mass that has to stop. You get, even though you've got bigger tires and contact on the road, from what I remember and what I know, is it takes a little more to make it stop, and yeah, you get a little bit of slippy sliding.
Yeah, particularly the buses that were in existence when Bob is describing his incident, they quite possibly didn't have anti-lock braking of the quality you can now buy in a good automobile, and maybe the tires were not up to the kind of quality we can buy of tires right now. But if somebody put an accelerometer on that bus and you did a panic stop on the bus and that accelerometer said a little bit greater than 0.75 G, I would believe it. And at 0.75 G, if your arms are wrapped around one of the poles in the middle of the bus because you're standing room only, and if you're standing a strong enough person, you might be able to hold on to that pole. As you start approaching 1G, not many people have enough strength to do that. You're going to break away and start moving. The bottom line is a seatbelt, a properly installed seatbelt, can give you a hell of a lot more protection than anything you can do with your hands and arms, even though you have forewarning that a big stop is about to take place. There's somebody who said a comment. Who was that? Give me your full call letters and name, and then proceed with your question or comment. KTRIW in the TechNet.
This is KD2IXB. This is John. Can you copy me okay?
Copy you very well, John. And you're one of the guys that I shipped a copy of that memo to. And you're allowed to sit here, agree with it or disagree with it. You got it, John.
I absolutely... Okay, quick, Keith. I absolutely do agree with that. But there's something that people need to remember with objects in motion. It's not based upon the weight of the object. It's based upon the kinetic energy. And kinetic energy is figured out as mass times the velocity squared. So the same mass traveling at a greater speed will have a much higher kinetic energy. We know this in EMS because this is how, you know, when accidents occur, when automobiles are in collisions, we can figure out the amount of damage to the patients by the velocity of the vehicles involved. Let me let it drop. This is why a woman or a person holding an infant who may only weigh 10 pounds in their arms, when the vehicle comes to a sudden stop, that 10 pounds, if the vehicle had been traveling, let's say at highway speeds, let's say 40 miles an hour, when that vehicle comes to the sudden stop, it's the 10 pounds times the velocity squared, times 40 miles per hour squared. So that 10-pound baby becomes a little 1,100-pound object that no human can hold. And that's why the kid ends up smashed against the dashboard. That's what brought about the need for child safety seats and seat belts and six airbags, sometimes eight airbags in cars. To overcome that dramatic increase in kinetic energy.
HUC with a comment.
HUC, Steve recognized. Get to you in a second. Good information, John. Yes, the amount of kinetic energy tells you the amount of damage that is capable in a worst case situation. On top of that, when you're in an automobile accident, how much of the car gets crushed, how much of the shock absorbing bumpers are doing their work and so on, means a very big variable. But in the worst case, a 40, 50, 60 mile an hour impact with something very solid, like a bridge abutment, the car could, in some cases, be experiencing 20 G's of deceleration, in which everything in the car becomes a large number of times heavier. And you're absolutely right. Holding on to that child is out of the question. You better be in a rear-facing, properly strapped down, child-restraining seat. And so there are two kinds of accidents that are happening these days that are not very well understood by the general public. Let me drop. Number one is the how well everybody has to be bound with a seatbelt in order to be safe in the worst-case accident situation. And if you could see slow-motion movies of dummies in cars that are going through impacts, you'll get a pretty good idea of how violent it is and how bad the damage can be. The other thing an awful lot of people don't realize is that if your car is going into water, because you're foolish enough to drive around a sign and you get into deep water like people have done in Houston, Texas, whenever your car is going into water, make sure a window is open. That's the only way you're going to leave that car. When the water is more than a foot or two above the bottom of the door on the outside of the car, the water pressure creates a number of hundreds and thousands of pounds of force on that door. Not even Arnold Schwarzenegger could open that door. Common sense would lead you to believe roll up the windows to keep the water out. Absolutely not. Roll down the windows so that in the worst case scenario, you can swim out the window. You're not going to open that door. Six people in the last couple of days died of drowning in their automobile in Houston, because the water rose above the wheels of the car, so to speak, and the person inside could not get out because he had not been instructed ahead of time. Make sure the window is open if you're entering water. Go over to you, Steve. That's HUC, KTRIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick. I have some comments to you. One, I agree with John and I agree with Eric. You know, the mass of the vehicle is certainly going to affect its braking distance. It's for that reason that over by the train, different classes of service have different speed restrictions. But, you know, you can't change the distance between signals and switches and crossings and such. So the only thing you can adjust based upon the weight of the vehicle you're operating is speed. So that's why passenger service, which is relatively lighter, where the, you know, the number of axles can run much faster than freight, which is obviously heavier for the number of axles. Let me let it drop and I'll get on to the second. The second comment I have is I would like to see a copy of that memo, if you wouldn't mind. Some pertinent information that I happened to come across a number of years ago, I bought a nifty little device called a car chip. And basically it plugs into the port, and it just sits there, and it's powered from the port. It just monitors the car's performance, statistics, and such. I noticed this particular model, when you download the information, it has every acceleration and every braking event that the car makes during a trip. You let it drop. What I found very interesting was that the port that comes from this chip has entries that are flagged as hard starts and hard acceleration, meaning the car's computer is calculating each, you know, every time you jam on the brake or step on the brake, the car's computer is calculating the G-forces, I'm assuming based upon the speed, the rate of deceleration and such, and flags anything that's over what the manufacturer deems necessary. And I'm wondering if they utilize any of that information when they calculate how long you have to stop when approaching an amber light. They may be forcing you to violate the vehicle manufacturer's requirements for what they consider a hard start or a hard stop. Just wondering if you knew that. Over to you, KDQHC.
Just a little comment, Dick. Okay, who wants to make a comment? Please give us your call letters and name. Go right ahead. And then we'll go back to Steve.
And I just wanted to point out to Steve that the OBDC2 connector, most of the computers that in version 2, because there's no OBDC1, they actually have an accelerometer chip in. mounted in the car somewhere, so they'll actually have to try and calculate the force if they read it directly.
Yeah, that's nice to know, Eric. In my opinion, rarely do any of us doing a reasonable stop exceed a deceleration rate of 0.3G. 0.3G is moderately hard braking. It will make other people on the car, other passengers feel uncomfortable. It's not going to be throwing them around violently, but they're at the threshold of being uncomfortable. If you want to know what a 0.3G deceleration feels like, you can very easily do that. Choose some unoccupied road near your house. Go exactly 40 miles an hour. Apply what you think is moderately hard braking, not a panic brake, moderately hard braking that you're likely to use the next time you come up to a traffic light or a stop sign. If your car goes from 40 miles an hour down to zero, complete stop, in 6 seconds, you have done a 0.3G deceleration. So 40 miles an hour to zero in 3 seconds. You try that, you'll be amazed how hard that braking is. You look at the specifications of your automobile. The specifications will brag about how good the anti-lock braking is. And most likely they will come up with numbers that represent 0.75, 3/4 of a G of braking. The car is capable of doing that. Let me drop it. But under normal circumstances, I strongly recommend you do not use the maximum panic braking capability, panic stop braking capability of your car. If absolutely nobody else is on the road, you're probably all right. If there's anybody else behind you, any reasonable distance, he's going to strike you. You're going to get a rear-end collision. And so these red light cameras, the vendors of those red light cameras are admitting that at a number of intersections, the number of tail-end collisions is now considerably increased since they've installed the red light cameras. And whether or not the risk-to-benefit ratio is the right ratio, and by the way, according to Newsday, in the year 2014, the last year that there is records, they issued 444,000 citations on Long Island and collected $33 million in citation money because of red light cameras. It's quite a money-making deal. And of all my friends that I've talked to, almost every one of them has been hit by one of those red light cameras, and they paid a citation. A high percentage of the population is being hit with these things. And you can either say that these are not safe drivers, or the device itself is a bit excessive. Let me drop it. And in this memo that I wrote, I analyzed a particular red light intersection, the one at Pine Lawn Road and Half Hollow Road in Millville. At that intersection, it happens to be the main thoroughfare by which the Newsday employees, a mile further south down that road, they tended to use Pine Lawn Road as a convenient way to get to the expressway. A good percentage of those employees now take other back roads to avoid that light because that light, in their opinion, is creating entrapment. If you happen to be 170 feet from that light, going at 40 miles an hour, which is the speed limit, when it turns yellow, if you jam on the brakes, it's too late. If you go at a steady speed, it's too late. They've got you. If you happen to be in that magic distance from that particular light, roughly 170 feet, and unless you use panic braking and stand the chance of somebody behind you hitting you, then you're going to be getting a citation at that light if you happen to be in that magic distance. And now plus or minus 170 feet. If you're a little bit more than 170 feet, you do braking. If you're a little bit less than 170 feet, you keep going steady speed. How many of us can accurately estimate within plus or minus 5 feet the distance between you and an intersection when you are 170 feet away? How many of us are that accurate in that estimate? Get it wrong, and you've got a ticket, and you're going to be paying $90. So there are a good number of people who think that situation is a bit unfair, and so this memo I wrote on that subject goes to the specifics of that. Let me drop it. And I think this situation has existed for this number of years, because very few people feel comfortable doing a deceleration calculation. In theory, you've got to do it by an integration. There happens to be some simpler ways of doing it. But the mathematics of calculating what does 3/10 of a G of deceleration do, and what is your stopping distance, and what is your stopping time, and do you have enough time to do this before this light, which, by the way, that light turns yellow for exactly 4.3 seconds, then it turns red. So if you're in that magic spot away from the light, roughly 170 feet, there's a high probability